Welcome to Crossing the Divide, the official podcast, a grassroots multimedia exploration of the intricacy of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide elevates local voices to educate the community on regional matters and fosters cooperative engagement in overcoming the unique challenges of life west of the Continental Divide, not New York, not LA. Crossing the Divide is a unique tribute to life in the Continental in between. Support for Crossing the Divide comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. In this edition of Crossing the Divide's official podcast, we'll explore the complex history of the Old Spanish Trail, a system of trading routes stretching from Santa Fe through Colorado, passing through Mesa County all the way to LA. The trail's existence as a trade and transportation route plays a vital role in many facets of Southwest history, with routes that could extend back tens of thousands of years. I'll talk with Vicki Felmley, president of the Old Spanish Trail Association, about ongoing research and preservation efforts along the 2,000 plus miles of this historic route. She'll divulge interesting historical details about the people and places that shaped the Old Spanish Trail's story. So, Vicki, welcome to the first podcast of 2019 for Crossing the Divide.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Old Spanish Trail Association?
Mm-hmm. The association started in the early 1990s, about 1994, down in the San Luis Valley. Several people, this is very well documented, got together and realized that there was an historic trail trending through their area. Looking at the various books, Hafen and Hafen, that was written in the 30s or the 40s. It's a well-documented book, well over 50, 60 years old. But those types of books were really generating a lot of interest in the Old Spanish Trail coming up from Santa Fe. Where did it go? Why were people doing it? Why were people, why were they on it at any given time? And, of course, the different segments. So about 1994, some people got together and formed an association to recognize the historical value of the trail. In the subsequent years, there was an effort or two to interest Congress in making it an historical trail. And in 2002, that was successful due to the efforts of local folks here in Mesa County. Jim Robb, the late Jim Robb, the late Bill Chenoweth. Bill just passed away just a few months ago. We just lost him. Our Earl and Dolly Huser, Jack and Catherine Nelson, those are the names that always crop up whenever we talk about the 2002 designation. Scott McGinnis, who's now a county commissioner, he was the Colorado representative, one of them, and he and Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who was the senator at the time, they sponsored the legislation to get that done. It took a while. It was not, obviously, this type of thing is not a thing that you do one week, and it took 3 or 4 years, a lot of dogged determination to do that. The National Historic and Scenic Trail System, now it encompasses both, is a trail network throughout the United States. Many trails that are familiar to you, the Appalachian Trail, Trail of Tears, Pacific Crest Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, the Oregon Trail. The Oregon-California Trail, I can just list them off, the Ice Age Trail. And so the Old Spanish Trail is now one of them. It has been since 2002. We are officiated, shall we say, by the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management. It's a co-agency experience for us. We get some funding from them. We get a lot of support from them. And a lot of help from them as well, not only for research, but protecting the trail segments that we have, for protecting the sites along the trail, and for recognizing areas so that public can go to learn more about the trail. Right now we have 4 certified sites. We will get probably at least that many this next year in the 6-state area. So the association not only protects and preserves and research, we're educating talking about the trail, talking about the people on the trail. Right now we have 14 chapters, active chapters, and we have one in New Mexico, we have two in California, two in California, and then we have the Descendants, which is based in California, but it's trail-wide. We have several in Utah, one in Arizona, one in Nevada. So, you know, we have a lot of activity going on, a lot of field trips, again, research, and just information that if you want to know about, really, Southwest history, we're almost the go-to folks for all of that.
Tell us a little bit about your own involvement and the history of your involvement, because you are right now president of the association.
Right. Well, as most people know, you know, if you say yes enough times, they make you president. Okay. So
I thought that was if you don't show up to the meeting.
Well, there is that too. There is that too. I got involved with protecting that particular 7 miles. It's called the 7 mile stretch, the 7 mile segment of the Old Spanish Trail from Orchard Mesa to Whitewater. Several years ago, there was a threat to the Old Spanish Trail segment here in Mesa County. And the neighborhood was galvanized, just absolutely galvanized and outraged about what could have happened, and formed a group called Omnia, Orchard Mesa Neighbors in Action, and got a tremendous amount of local support. As a result, fast forward, that segment is now an officially recognized route by the National Park Service. And the county reinforced that with a new prescribed easement. The easement had been scribed in like 1886, I don't remember exactly the date, but something like that. And so the county renewed that easement. They resurveyed it, and they renewed it, bring it into the 21st century. So there are protections, but there always has to be eyes on the ground. And as a result of that, and getting that segment recognized by the National Park Service and doing the research, which took about 2 years. Again, that wasn't an overnight thing. That took about 2 years to do, to get the approvals and everything else. Then they asked me to be Colorado director, and I said, sure, I can do that. And then a little over a year ago, they asked if I'd be president, and I said, yeah, I guess I can do that too. But I was always interested in not only history, but how it affects what we do now, the decisions that we make now. You know, whether it's an old building or an old trail, or just people thinking that, well, my family has been here. I'm a third generation or fourth generation or fifth generation Coloradans. You hear that a lot. How does that affect our positions? How does that affect our decisions on what we do, not only for ourselves, but for our community as well? So whenever I've been involved in anything, I'm one of those people who say, well, what have we done before? What documentation can we find? What's been written about before? You know, where are our things like as boring as bylaws, but also things as interesting as previous ideas, previous visions. What have people thought about before? So I really like I've always liked to go into those types of things before I make a decision about what I'm doing today. I really want to see what's been done before. Part of that is that I don't want to reinvent the wheel again. I don't want to make the same mistakes somebody made 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, because that's very common and that's very easy to do. So part of that is that reasoning as well. But also, I think it's a way to respect what others have done and what others have said and what others have planned, the ideas that they've had, and take them into the present and go, well, you know, that wasn't a bad idea. Maybe we should work on that one. And again, respect what they did. Respect the people who came before us. All of those things. That's what has always interested me and I think driven me to some degree to everything that I've done.
Is the trail demarcated at all of the main points?
No. There's a network of trails. There are a couple of reasons. One is the weather. If the weather was bad in one area, you could go into another. Another reason was trade. What were they doing? The North Branch, for example, was used more for fur trappers. up through this area and into Utah. But the third reason also was the continued and growing issue with hostiles. So there were several reasons why there are several segments, practical reasons. Somebody asked me at one of my classes, why did they choose this particular way to go? Well, one of the reasons is they were following rivers as much as they could. Water was very important. This is the Southwest Desert we're talking about here. So water was staying as close to water as possible, or at least being able to fill containers with good water going towards a stretch that didn't have any water. You know, those were important considerations if you think about it. So those were another reason. And then, of course, the other reason in Arizona is what's called the Big Ditch, the Grand Canyon. So that was a little bit of an encumbrance, too, in northern Arizona. So that particular segment of the trail is very, very interesting. How Native Americans, of course, traveled it for 2,000, 3,000, or 4,000 years, and then the Anglos, the Spanish, and Mexican traders, and so forth, just continued that. So there are several. It's a network of trails, just like there is a network in most of the trails, for several reasons. That's what we really want to. That's one of the things we are working. We have been for several years. The Mesa County one is, of course. The BLM is really helping with recreation and development strategies because we want the segments open and kept open for recreation opportunities, horseback riding, mountain biking, hiking, and walking. There's a couple areas in Nevada that is, a couple segments in Utah. There's one in Arizona that's coming up. And the San Luis Valley, they're talking more and more about recreation segments. And so it's pieces and parts. It's pieces and parts, again, because so much of it has been paved over or turned into shopping malls and housing developments and things like that. They said from I-70 from here into Utah and then turning into I-15 going into California, that is the trail, or at least closely parallels the trail. There are a few segments that can still be recognized that are a few hundred feet away from I-70 or I-15, but for the most part, when you're traveling on I-70 or I-15, you are on the Old Spanish Trail.
That's an interesting point. Certain parts of the trail, that history might have ended, so to speak. But the more you can keep other segments alive, mm-hmm. that history then continues into the future. It's still being utilized. And so the story continues.
Right. Exactly. The story continues, and the more people who get out on the trail, I've led several outdoor experiences on the trail out here in Mesa County, and the more people who see it and who see the history, they get excited. We're also looking at more and more experiences out in the McGinnis Canyons area because the trail, there are trail segments, there are recognized trail segments out in that area as well. And we have tremendous volume of historical drawings from Loring, for example, in the 1850s. His artist, one thing about these survey crews, they always had artists with them. Fascinating stuff. One of our members is very avidly, he's collected these for years and then has taken the time on his own to go back to those places where the artist drew and then take contemporary pictures of them to show what they look like in the 1850s, show what they look like now. He's given several talks, and it's just wonderful. So, but McGinnis Canyons is one of those areas where there are several historical drawings, and then you can see those, what they look like in the 1850s and see them now. So McGinnis Canyons is an area that we're going to be looking at more and more for recreation potential to open those up and signage. In fact, come to think of it, they just got a grant to do that. Our Native American board members are also very, very active in preservation and educating folks about not only the trail but the different aspects of their experiences, of the Native American experiences. And one of our newer board members, she is representing the Navajo Nations down in New Mexico, and she works avidly with many, many groups, government agencies, to raise awareness not only about the reservation and those areas in New Mexico and Arizona, but also the trail systems, and again, plural, throughout that whole area. You know, we don't shy away from our Native American history with the trail. We don't shy away from slavery. We don't shy away from the fact that the trail was a indigenous trail, and that the Native Americans, it was Native American pottery and textiles that were in such high demand to trade for the mules and horses. Our scope of work from our members, our research committee and everything, it can encompass, petroglyphs from, way back to descendants and travelers, the military surveyors in the 1860s, 1870s, so we do have a broad, spectrum of years that we're looking at. We tend to try to concentrate more on the trail itself and the time period of the early 1800s, but it's very fluid. It is fluid. And as president, I definitely encourage anybody to look at the whole spectrum.
I guess I'm a little curious as to how the trail gets its name, the Old Spanish Trail, if we know that there was a lot of Indian trading going on as well. How did it end up with that particular moniker?
Well, whoever writes the history gets to make the history. I believe it was Kit Carson. If anybody's out there listening, I think it was Kit Carson who used the term Spanish Trail in the first place. And now where the old came from, nobody really seems to know where that particular word came and why it was put there in front of the whole thing. So it was not, certainly not designated, much before that as any named trail. So where the old came from, don't know. But the term Spanish Trail was documented in a logbook, and that's what happened there.
What are some of the main sources of research that people are relying on to help tell the story of the Old Spanish Trail in terms of building that history?
Logs and ledgers from Santa Fe, for example, what was traded and so forth, and of course on the Los Angeles area as well. The fur trappers in the North Branch, again, that documentation is mostly like from Kit Carson and the Rubidoux family. I say brothers, but there seemed to be quite a number of that family that came through this area. And several others. It was mostly logs and ledgers. What is fascinating to me, and I'm glad you bring this up, because when you look at the history of the Spanish coming into, for example, Central America, South America, Central America, and Mexico, beginning in the early 1500s, predominantly, there's a plethora of written information, diaries, letters back home, journals. There was so much by 1580 or 1590, the Spanish monarchy was really trying to stifle the publication of journals and diaries and books to disseminate throughout Europe, because they really kind of wanted to keep it quiet. And mostly probably because of the silver mines, all the silver and gold that was being brought back. And, of course, that didn't work. The cat was out of the bag by then,
yeah.
Of course.
That's pretty tough to
tomatoes and potatoes had already made their way back. So by then, it was like, it's anybody's game. But somewhere in the 1700s, late 1700s, those writings were drying up. I've always found it kind of remarkable, and I've always asked, researchers and historians about this, and they said, well, they're there, but you just really have to look for them. And boy, no kidding. In fact, this is kind of an interesting side. Again, this is one of those side trips that I talk about. The Spanish land grant controversy, it's still a controversy, where Spain gave vast tracts of land to Spanish families in the American Southwest, Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Arizona, not so much in Utah, but predominantly that area, and of course California later on with the missions. But they gave these huge tracts of land, and of course the United States government pretty much commandeered them after 1850. You know, they're ours.
Yeah.
And so there's still a controversy about that. There are still people who really have a kind of a sore spot about that. Well, several years ago, there were some individuals who were really making an issue about it, and one of them actually traveled to Spain, spent 2 or 3 years in Spain going through all the libraries and museums trying to find as much documentation as possible to make their case. So the documentation is there, but again, like one historian said, you just really have to look for it. The Dominguez Escalante Journal, which was, of course, in 1775, 76, that area there, that was well documented. Most of us who are aficionados have copies of that. I have mine. But beyond that, there's not a whole lot. And it is frustrating, very frustrating. It's also challenging, very challenging.
Are you relying on volunteers to do some of that research, or are there grants, people? You're finding grant money to do that? How does that work?
Many people just, they do it on their own. They're scholars. They're, you know, they're university, college people doing it as well. Most of our grants are for preservation. That's where, you know, when we have money, a lot of it does go for preservation and signage. Signage is a big thing with us.
Yeah, I didn't imagine.
And I don't think I realized how big it was until I became Colorado director. And it's like, well, we're talking a lot about signs, aren't we? Yeah, we're talking a lot. Yeah, signs is a big thing. And it's true, because if we don't sign it, people do not know that it's there.
Yeah.
Or that it was there. So that's where most of our grant money goes to. But research, we encourage it. And some of our people do get grants on their own. A lot of it's a labor of love, labor of love. But we do, you know, we do try, you know, for example, Armijo did keep a diary, but there's some missing pages. So people, look in your attics, your basements or whatever, because we're still looking for those missing pages.
It could be out there.
They could
you
be
never
out
know.
There. We never know. That's right. Exactly. What's interesting is that some of our members, they find the most interesting maps and things on eBay. Old maps and whatnot that people had no idea what it was, so they just take a scan of it and put it on eBay and sell it for $4.
How far does it stretch?
Well, if you take up all the segments, it's around 2,700 miles. That's adding up all the segments. If you take the Armijo route, which was the first attempt, and actual successful attempt, I should say, from Santa Fe to the Los Angeles area by Armijo, and that was the designated 1828-1829 time period. That's approximately 1,100 to 1,300 miles, depending on kind of, there are some twists and turns on that trail as well. But the rest of them, if you add it all together, is around 2,700 miles.
You've mentioned Armijo a couple times. Is that mm-hmm. an expedition you want to talk about a little bit more in depth at all?
Well, he was a very well-known personage, shall we say. He was a military person, very politically wired with Spain and later Mexico, of course. And you know, he's very Googleable, Armijo, and he took it upon himself to go to California with textiles, with pottery and blankets, to sell in Los Angeles and bring back mules and horses. He only did it once, but he is our grandfather, our great-great-great-grandfather, the great-great-grandfather of the old Spanish Trail. He did it once, but that was enough to prove that it could be done, and could be done in a fairly expeditious manner as well. By far, one of the most popular exhibits that we have, or that we can provide people, is a mule packing demonstration. And there are people who do that, who use the very, very historically accurate pieces and parts to pack a mule. And what was also interesting is that mules are cultivated, shall we say, at a very early age. And once they're grown, that pack goes with that mule until it dies. Those packs are specifically built, molded around that particular mule's back and sides. Did not know that. I just learned that a few months ago. Very interesting how specialized this is. This is high tech for the 1800s.
For the time, absolutely.
This is high tech stuff. And when they left Santa Fe, everything was carefully packed. They didn't want to lose anything because that meant they were going to lose money, obviously. So I asked about that at a conference once, and there were some Oregon Trail people there, and I said, you know, I mean, has everything just been picked up, you know, over the years? He says, no, there was never that much to pick up. And I said, but the Oregon Trail, and that's all I needed to say was, but the Oregon Trail, and whammo. Well, we think about the Oregon Trail. Okay, so people are coming from back east, and they're leaving whatever situation back home. They're coming to the west to make a new life, and they've got wagons. They've got wagons, and they are filled with grandma's china, with the piano that they can't leave behind, all the clothes, more stuff. But with each passing period of time, you know, as the trail, you know, it's a little bit longer, they didn't know it was going to take so long, and the horses or mules or oxen, whatever is pulling, getting a little tired, things start getting chucked out of the wagon on either side. So there go grandma's china, and there goes the piano, and there goes all the steel tools or metal tools that they thought they'd need, but now they really need that. And so that's why the Oregon Trail is still such a gold mine for archaeologists and for treasure hunters, because
that's an interesting distinction.
Yeah, it really is. And so that's like a night and day difference. Because you can visualize them checking out this stuff on either side of the wagons.
Yes,
but the old Spanish trail, no, they ain't checking nothing. Because it was a different usage, different purpose altogether, and a different market. Let's put it this way, you know, there were not families leaving back east with all sorts of stuff. That was not a particular market that the trail was serving, shall we say. Yeah, so, you know, I've learned a lot, and I continue to learn a lot. We had an interesting discussion that I was just fascinated by. We had a sign going up and shows mules being led down kind of a cliffside. And so I thought, well, just for the heck of it, I'm going to send it over to our research committee and see what they say. You know, I guess I was bored that day. I really had no ulterior motives to do this, okay? And within 10 minutes, oh my gosh, no, you cannot have this depict this way. I said, I'm emailing him, what do you mean? The mules were not tethered. They weren't tethered. And in this picture, yes, they're tethered. You can clearly see the tethers. And the guy said, you got to get those photoshopped out. So I emailed back, why? He said, very, very simple. Mules are herd animals. They will follow each other. They will not wander off. And think about it. The Old Spanish Trail is considered one of the most arduous, most difficult trails in all the Americas. Lots of cliffs, lots of gullies, lots of places where mules can trip and fall. So if they're tethered, you don't lose one mule and its pack, you lose 20.
Yeah.
Good point.
That is a good point.
So now I think about that. Now those are the things that I think about whenever I see anything depicting the Old Spanish Trail. The Old Spanish Trail, it's interesting, has been called a hard pack trail. In fact, some of our members are very, very avid in believing that. And I really can't dispute it because I've kind of seen it. When you see the trail, the Old Spanish Trail, it's so distinctive from others because nothing grows on either side of it for like several feet. In fact, we had a botanist at our conference here in Grand Junction a little over 2 years ago that was mentioned to him, and he was like, it kind of took him aback. He said, "Really?" And we said, "Yeah, we can show you. We can take you out there. We can take you to Nevada. We can take you to Utah. We can take you here to Mesa County, and nothing grows on it."
So that's across the entirety of the
pretty route? Much is. It really is. It's a condition of. It's a hard packed trail, and maybe because of all those thousands and thousands of fuel sources, what people are finding and understanding is that 2,550 years ago, the botanical aspect of this whole area was vastly different than what it is now. In fact, the botanist that I was talking about, who was talking to our conference, he mentioned that several times, that there were grasses, it was lush, it was much wetter. And so it was much more ideal for bringing in horses and mules along, and because they had forage. And this is everywhere in the Southwest, not just here, but this is everywhere. So just from that aspect, what we can learn from vegetation 150 years ago and the impact that invasive species have had on our area throughout the whole six-state region is profound. It is amazing. That is amazing, an amazing aspect of something else that we've learned, too, that there was much more vegetation, much more sustainable vegetation in most of these areas than there is now. Invasive species has really messed things up. When you read about, when you read about the fur trappers and whatnot, and what they saw and what we're seeing now is vastly different. Invasive species certainly has made a huge impact. And I've heard this from other botanists. In fact, Curtis Martin, we had a field trip and he was on, and Susan Rose, I don't know if you know her or not, she was the Tri-River Extension wildflower person. Hmm. She was on it too, and she talked about this, how invasive species has degraded not only the native species, but the soil, the things that just aren't sustainable anymore because of the invasive species. So, and of course, livestock grazing has made an impact. So it's like a 12-piece puzzle. It's not just one piece; it's several pieces that are all integrated in how the changes have happened in the last 150 years.
What do you personally feel is the importance of having these areas designated and continuing that knowledge into the future? What is it about this trail in particular that you feel needs to be documented and people need to know about?
I think that I get that a lot, and it's kind of a tough nut to explain because it's not a building. You know, it's not like an old 1700 building back east that people will spend tens of million dollars to preserve and protect and rebuild and everything like that. We don't have any of that. We don't have those. What we have, though, is a reminder of the history, because without that designation, without the people doing the research, and they have been for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, we wouldn't know about, for example, our Miho. We wouldn't know about many of the other people who traveled from Santa Fe to Los Angeles. Los Angeles was built pretty much on the backs of people who traveled the Old Spanish Trail from Santa Fe. A lot of people don't realize that. There are William Workman, for example, who is kind of considered one of the pioneers of Los Angeles. He came to Los Angeles on the Old Spanish Trail. So there are just so many families and names that are engulfed in this history. And if we didn't know about the trail, we wouldn't know about them. That might be a loss. That might be a tremendous loss. And if we didn't know about the trail, we might not know about People like Chief Wakara, I mentioned him a little while ago to you. You know, again, Google that name, W-A-U-K-A-R-A, and you'll find all sorts of fascinating information about this guy. We wouldn't know about him and what he did because he is so tied to the Old Spanish Trail because he used it as the route to get his stolen horses and mules from Los Angeles back into the other states to sell or trade to give to Native Americans or whomever who would buy them. I asked one of our California members who's really heavily into the research about this. I'd read about that Chief Wakara and others would sweep into these areas there in California and steal thousands. I mean, the word always was thousands of mules or horses. And I said, were there really thousands of mules and horses? I mean, you know, each one, you know, thousands here, a thousand here, a thousand there. And he said, yeah, he said many of the missions, that was their, how they made their money. They bred and raised mules and horses to specifically sell and trade. That was how they made most of their money. He said, in fact, it's kind of an interesting aspect. Chief Wakara, in particular, was capable of sweeping in and stealing 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 mules from these various missions, and several of them went out of business. They decided, well, to heck with this. There's got to be better ways to make money. Our inventory just got depleted overnight. And I said, so there was kind of a bubble in the mule industry there. And he said, that's a way to put it. The bubble burst, and so they went out of business just because of people like Chief Wakara. So I was really fascinated by that this is how they made their money and this is what they did. So when Chief Wakara swept down, pretty much decimated their economies. And that kind of comes full circle to your question. Why are we interested in this? Because that kind of knowledge, that kind of information would be lost.
Yeah.
Besides the fact that it's just downright interesting, this is part of our heritage. This is part of who we are, or it should be considered who we are, not only as Americans, but also as people who live on this planet with everybody else.
We know that you're working with a lot of passionate people with the association. How do you feel in terms of getting the wider public engaged or interested in the history of the Old Spanish Trail? Do you find it difficult?
It depends. There are people who are interested in history, and then there are people who aren't. You know, it's just that black and white. What we are trying to do, though, is more and more reach out to other groups and to introduce history to them, perhaps on the off chance that they might be interested. As an example, we're doing two things this year. One of them, we're going to be partnering with the local astronomy society and have a star party that hopefully will be over six states. All of our chapters and various astronomy societies over six states, we're designating a weekend in May, and we're going to have live feeds, Facebook feeds, to get people interested in not only the trail on their feet, but also what's going on above us. One of our members, Colonel Al Matheson, he gave a talk on celestial navigation along the Old Spanish Trail here about a year ago, a little over a year ago. That really got me to thinking, it's like, well, that really brought, I mean, we're so used to eyes on the ground, you know, literally looking on the ground. We haven't been looking up. We need to look up more. And he really brought that home to me. So we're looking at more and more, engaging people who are interested in the things, the idea that we'll introduce our history. Maybe they'll be interested, but most importantly, we want to be interested in what they're doing too. We need to look up. We need to look out more. And so we think that the Star Party is going to be a great example of how, what we can do. We're also having our next conference in Cedar City, Utah. That's going to be in October. And the theme is going to be travelers on the trail. Again, not the trail itself, but people who use the trail, We're not going to be talking about dirt. We're going to be talking about people who walked on that dirt. And so that's another way that we want to reach out to people, looking at partnering with a couple other groups on that conference.
So if there are people out there listening who maybe have heard of the Old Spanish Trail, maybe they haven't, but we've piqued their interest, how can they get involved in helping your efforts?
Well, go to oldspanishtrail.org and look through it. There's a lot of information. We do have a very active Facebook page, too. Just find Old Spanish Trail Association. And, we encourage membership. But we know that a lot of people won't be members. But if you participate in our Facebook page, you'll find out a lot about activities, field trips, and whatnot throughout the six-state region. We really want participants to not only help us, but also to find out more about the trail and its history as well. We love people to join, and thank you, Gretchen, for being a member.
I am.
You get a magazine, which we have copies of sitting in front of us right now. We also have discounts on conferences. And look for opportunities with the chapters, again, with field trips or out here. We have a couple of times a year, we have a cleanup crew, always have lots of people, participants in that, because people use the 7-mile segment a lot. And so every so often it does need to be cleaned up. So I think the other thing too is, be aware of just all of the different aspects, not only with the Old Spanish Trail, but all of your local history. I really, really encourage people to get involved with local history, no matter where you're at.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to follow us on Facebook and now on Instagram at Crossing the Divide to keep up on latest releases and other events. Crossing the Divide is also available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. Find us on any of those platforms and hit subscribe to stay plugged in. We're looking forward to bringing you more local voices in 2019. Crossing the Divide, cultivating community through conversation. This podcast was recorded at 970 West Studio in Grand Junction, Colorado.